You are listening to Radio Free Space, WDRT's Community Access Hour. Today we feature Charlie Knower's interview with former Buddhist monk and current teacher and translator, Santi Caro. Listen now as he discusses Buddhist principles and how they affect current life in the U.S.
When we talked in 2012, you were recovering from cancer treatments and operations, and I began that interview with this question. What does suffering and the end of suffering mean to you in your daily life? You're currently less than a year out from another cancer treatment, and I would like to ask that question again. But before I do, if you could briefly explain what suffering or dukkha is.
There are numerous ways to come at the teaching around dukkha or suffering. One that's a good starting point and not limited to Buddhists is unnecessary distress, where things are happening in life, maybe not going our way, nasty illness or a conversation with someone's frustrating. These are just part of life. But when we make distress out of such events, the weather, the current politics, which has always been a mess anyway, that unnecessary distress is suffering. Now, many people would question that it's unnecessary, and that gets into the so-called origin of suffering. But before we go there, there's a traditional image of this, which is a ox cart wheel that wobbles. The etymology of the word dukkha is when something does not rotate smoothly. There's grit caught in there, it's out of balance, out of whack. So suffering can be also seen as when our life is out of balance, out of harmony, off kilter, out of whack. We experience that as suffering, which applies to things, for example, going how we want them to. And we get so excited about that, we're almost drunk. That's dukkha as well.
But is suffering ever present? Is suffering a part of life that we should just simply learn to accept?
In the early teachings, the original word dukkha has a range of meanings based on context, though what's appropriately translated as suffering or misery or being ill at ease is not necessary.
And so how does that fit into your recent cancer treatment operations, etc.? It seems like there could be lots of physical pain involved with that. And that could, for me, for example, produce suffering, what I would think would be suffering. But does it have to produce that suffering, or is there a way for me to mitigate that suffering?
I was fortunate there wasn't much pain. There were at times 15 years ago with my first go-around with lymphoma, but there was lots of fatigue, some nausea off and on, some vomiting, lots of discomfort, not so much pain. But I know many people equate pain, illness, etc. with suffering, but I don't. Illness, discomfort, fatigue is suffering when I take it personally. It's suffering when it's mine. I am having this. And within that is some pushback. I don't want this. I don't like this. And that creates me. There's an identity. There's someone I think I am. And I take it personally. So there are a lot of things that more or less I wasn't taking personally. These machines, I went through stem cell transplant. The process of collecting stem cells is being hooked up to a machine, a lot like dialysis. And it's weird, not particularly painful, but kind of weird. Is this me? Not necessarily. To common sense for most Americans, that may not make sense. I'm not laying there in the bed saying it's not me. It's just there's this machine doing its thing. There are nurses checking. There's all kinds of sensations, sounds. I could also watch a movie while it was going on, read a book. There's all these things happening, none of which need to be taken personally. In the early teachings, the original word dukkha has a range of meanings. Based on context, though, what's appropriately translated as suffering or misery or being ill at ease is not necessary.
It feels like an immense amount of practice on your part to put those things into perspective. I hear what you're saying as there is suffering, but it's not my suffering. In the same way, can you say there is anger, but it's not my anger, I don't own the anger, or other emotions? How does somebody get to that point of being able to see things in that perspective?
My understanding, which aligns with the early or original Buddha's perspective, is such things are suffering. Pain, discomfort, loss, aging, illness, these are all part of life. That doesn't make them suffering. It's suffering because we don't like them. We don't want them. The suffering is in the dislike and wishing them to be otherwise. And that wishing creates the me that identifies my suffering. It's not suffering without the my.
And how does that, what could be suffering, transform into you to some sort of equanimity that you have around it?
Well, equanimity is part of what's left. When the judgments, reactions that cause suffering fade, dissolve, cool away, what's left is just life, alive, heartbeat, breathing, sensation, and there's an emotional balance, which could be called equanimity. There's a calmness, an inner spaciousness. And Buddhism understands that as what's normal. That's normal. In our Western medical model, we have not normalized health. The big money is elsewhere. But for the Buddha, what is normal is inner peace, spaciousness, balance, which is also naturally kind and sensitive.
That really makes me want to go to this question. Knowing that you were a monk for 19 years, but at some point there was a start to your interest in it, what was appealing about Buddhism?
At the beginning, honestly, I don't quite remember back in college. But something that I remember clearly was towards the end of my Peace Corps service in Thailand, which was when I was more and more exposed to living Buddhism. It wasn't just from books. I was meditating off and on, and I picked up a little book by Ajahn Buddhadasa, who a while later became my teacher and still is. And the book really hit home at selfishness. And that hit me pretty strongly. Here I was in Peace Corps, supposedly doing good, helping people in rural Thailand. And mostly, I was a good school teacher. I was doing some helpful projects in local villages. I was considered a good, successful volunteer. But my interest in Buddhism at that time helped me to see my motives weren't always pure. I've been a competitive person for a long time. There's an opinionatedness. I would read stuff and go, that's cool. That's what we gotta do. And I was successful at finding people who would let me do these projects. And some of them did seem to have genuine benefits. But I saw my pushiness as selfish. And that tarnished just the fun of being out in villages with really nice people, having cool, what to some here in Wisconsin might seem exotic experiences. It was a sugar cane growing area. And once I was driving the school motorcycle home, and I went through a puddle of sugar cane juice mixed with the clay soil of the road. And I was just covered, and it was hot, and this reeked. It was pretty disgusting. But that was part of the life. Mostly I enjoyed zipping around on the motorcycle. It was also a banana growing area, a special kind called egg bananas, quite tasty. So usually I had some bananas on the handlebars because somebody gave me some bananas to take back to school. Anyway, there was a lot of just wonderful stuff, interacting with people, learning, but my self-centeredness tarnished that. That was what really engaged me with eventually ending up at Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery. I want to understand this. And I should also say, I had been working in the Thai school system for three and a half years. Some of my colleagues were not exactly dedicated to helping their students learn. And I would get outraged and upset and be critical. So much so, I caused too much trouble at my first school and was moved to a second school where I knew better to keep my anger under control. So I was also seeing how things in society, the secondary school system, but I was also working with the local vet, the local ag extension person. Those two guys were good. They did their job. They cared. Some others, though, that we worked with were just taking their paychecks and then doing the minimal work they could get away with. And those things really bugged me. And so the theme of selfishness, I saw, and more or less still do, is what causes our problems in societies, whether over there or what we're going through here today. And I wanted to understand selfishness. What is this thing? And so that led me deeper and deeper into Buddha's teachings and practice.
I'm having this wonderful picture in my mind of you meeting Ajahn Buddhadasa at the monastery and displaying the kind of behavior that you just talked about and thinking about how he might suggest corrections to that behavior. Did that happen?
Yes. My critical mindedness would find things that I thought were wrong. And after a while, I wasn't afraid or ashamed to complain. And he never told me what to do about that. But what he did ultimately was more effective. He did not react. And more and more and more quickly, as this would repeat this bad habit of mine as a young, opinionated American monk who thought he was smart, even though I deeply respected him, but there were others I didn't respect so much. He just sat there, maybe nodded. He did not frown. He did not smile. He just sat there, and there was no reaction. Most people react. There were people in the monastery who would agree with me, people who would argue with me. He didn't do either, nor did he judge. He just sat there. And after a while, I would become increasingly self-conscious of my unwholesome mental, emotional state. Unwholesome is a key word in Buddhism. One of the basic discriminations in wisdom or discernments is between what's wholesome, what's unwholesome. Kindness is wholesome, genuine kindness. Self-centered masquerading as kindness is manipulation. That's unwholesome. And his non-reaction increasingly allowed me to catch what was going on in me. I think most of us have these old habits, some of which go back to childhood, some of which go back to trauma, and they're more or less addictive. Not like certain substances, but the emotional energy. We just react with little self-control. Sometimes there's enough awareness, we bottle it up, and it churns away inside. So his non-reaction would allow me to catch the somewhat addictive energy, in this case of my annoyance, criticalness, and anger. So catching the ugliness of it and the pain, that's the dukkha part. The emotional, psychic pain, distress of such things. And as I stopped spinning with it and things would calm down, then he would talk about it and we would discuss some relevant teachings after I calmed down enough to have an intelligent conversation.
You are listening to WDRT's Radio Free Space. We return now to our interview with Buddhist teacher and translator, Santikaro.
What was your daily life like when you were in the monastery? And how quickly did you learn? What was the learning process?
So Suan Mok was a monastery set up for mature people in Ajahn Buddhadasa's eyes. So he didn't spend much time, at least while I was there at the end of his life, telling people what to do. There were certain regular activities, morning chanting at 4:30, evening service at 6. There would be public talks by him and others, eventually including me. And there was work to be done. Mostly, we were free to chart our own course. As monks, there's a training discipline that we vow to follow, some places more strictly, some less. And then there were lots of cultural expectations for monks. So as long as you didn't violate any of that too much, you had lots of freedom. And I did. So I joined in morning and evening chanting for a while. But just before I got there, monthly meditation retreats for foreigners were begun by the assistant abbot. And I was put to work helping, and over time became in charge of that. And then we also had people who stayed between these 10-day retreats. So my work was looking after the foreigners, organizing talks, answering questions, leading meditation sessions. But because I spoke Thai quite well, I was popular with groups like school kids. They can hear a talk from the American monk or activist groups, university students. I still had a small hut to go back to, meditate in the morning, the evening. During the day, if I didn't have other things to do, I would read. I loved to read. And there were plenty of books in English and Thai. And also, I began translating. I often had small translation projects.
From there, you became, at least back in the States here, when you got back, you became a Buddhist teacher, still are. You make trips every year to different locations to teach. You became a translator. Have most of your translations been of Ajahn Buddhadasa's Dharma talks?
All of them.
Do you have one planned?
There's this one book Ajahn Buddhadasa asked me to translate, and I've survived 2 bouts of serious lymphoma. So I'm thinking before the 3rd one, I think I should translate this book.
And broadly, what's the topic?
The title, which is a Thai-Sanskrit hybrid, Kaivalya Dhamma, means the truth of wholeness, or the reality of everythingness. And Ajahn Buddhadasa intended this as a reaching out to other religious traditions. He talks a lot about God, both Christian and Muslim. He had Muslim students. Southern Thailand had a small but important Muslim population, including in that area. And also the word Kaivalya is important in other Indian traditions, interpreted differently. He explains it in lots of ways. It's a 400-page book. And it's a way of seeing life as, you could say, he wouldn't quite say it this way, everything is one. Hmm. More, everything is within this whole.
That makes me think of this question. Is Buddhism a religion? Is there a deity?
Not like in Christianity.
But does that define a religion?
Some people think it does. Mm-hmm. We're in the U.S., and there's an old history of colonial arrogance and Christian missionaries who treated Buddhism pejoratively because Buddhism did not worship the one God. And so what has happened, and still in this culture, and even it still lingers a bit, I think, in the academic study of religion, that a notion of religion based on Christianity is the lens that Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism are viewed. Ajahn Buddhadasa would address this in various ways. Buddhism's a science in certain ways. It's a philosophy which originally the word meant love of wisdom. Sophia is wisdom. And Buddhism's an art. Currently, I would say it's a way of life. But I would say all religions ought to be a way of life more than a belief system.
It's probably a way of life in an Eastern country, in Thailand, for example, where, I don't know, I think you could argue it's the state religion, isn't it?
Constitutionally, no. Conservatives want to make it the state religion. More progressives think that's a bad idea because Muslims, Christians are maybe 1% of the population, plus some Hindus and Sikhs. Buddhism is enshrined quite a bit in official life.
I can't quite even imagine being born into that, even though you and I were born into a Christian culture here, which is part of our lives in so many, many ways, some of which I probably don't even notice sometimes.
You were responding to way of life, and I won't go off on Christianity, though I think there's some things Jesus is reported to have said. I am the way. I don't think he said, I am a belief system, which happened. The creeds and the wars over dogma and so on, and the violence. Buddhism isn't so much a creedal religion. It's full of teachings, but people aren't judged or persecuted on the basis of belief. But there is, on a cultural level, or there was, some expectations of behavior, which scholars of religion call orthopraxy. But as we discussed how many years ago?
13 years ago, yeah.
Thailand is now within the capitalist web. And just like here, I would say capitalism is the dominant value system, not Christianity. No matter how much certain Christians want their ideas, beliefs, whether or not they're what Jesus taught, they want those to be nationally dominant. Their issue isn't, say, Buddhism, even if they think it is, or Judaism, which they're exploiting for pretty ugly purposes these days, all the anti-Semitic hogwash. But their beef is with neoliberal capitalism and a hedonistic consumer culture. And similar things have pushed the Buddhism that used to be part of daily Buddhist life has weakened quite a bit, not just in the big cities like Bangkok, but everywhere. To finish that train of thought, living Buddhist practice or living religious practice is marginalized everywhere. In China, it's the mix of the Communist Party and their version of capitalism.
So let's follow up on that. On November 7th, 2024, one day after the presidential election, you wrote this on your Substack page. This election debacle feels like a recurrence of cancer. In that context, can you help explain a Buddhist perspective on how we got here, how we got to the current political, cultural place that we're in? And then secondly, the possibilities for making corrections or resolving that.
So this is something I've been pondering for years, and especially since November last year. One is the teaching of everything happens through causes, conditions, influences. And so to me, that's an important lens. How did we get here? Well, racism has always had a powerful place in white culture. That goes back 400 plus years. And part of the current regime is backlash against acknowledging racism. Now that, oh, we can't bring that up, that'll hurt people's feelings. Mm-hmm. People have been killed. And, oh, we don't want our tender young conservative children upset. But it's actually the adults who don't want to face these truths. So there's that mistreatment of immigrants who are allowed to come in or imported, especially from Central America. That's for the profits of American business, including big dairy farms in places like Wisconsin. These are things with a long history. Our worship of personal success measured in terms of profit in money, that goes way back. And the use of police forces to suppress labor unions, to beat up people of color, that's the history of big city police forces, Boston, New York, Chicago, Milwaukee, Portland. It's still alive in all these places. Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis wasn't the only bad apple. It's systemic. So those are just some primary examples. Throw in climate change and our profligate use of resources, especially fossil fuel. All these threads are coming together in a really toxic way, and it's bipartisan. So a thread I want to highlight, it's something I'm thinking about a lot now, is despite all those cultural currents and influences, cultural, social, political, economic, and religious, that are unwholesome, to use that term, unhealthy, and at core anti-life. There was also a lot of decent, good Christians, people who formed farm communities throughout this huge country and took care of each other because it was either the community or the local church or in some places synagogues or whatever. You had nothing until the New Deal. And what for a long time, and I think this is a Buddhist view, Ajahn Buddhadasa shared it, what held society together was the decency of a lot of ordinary people, which in this country centered on local churches for the most part, white churches, black churches, Hispanic, Catholic churches. That's changed now with Hindu temples, Buddhist places, and of course the important role of Judaism and synagogues. What I fear has really deteriorated since the Reagan and Clinton years, and I put those two together as really representing a self-centered value system, both of them in different ways. I disagreed with Clinton less than I disagreed with Reagan. But that era, I think integrity started getting chucked out the window. And that's accelerated until now. We've elected a president with zero integrity, or close to it, and a regime of extremely low integrity, which brings me to the last part of your question, which is the way out of this horrible mess. And I'll focus on this country, but it applies Thailand, Israel, elsewhere.
It's global.
Is bringing back integrity.
How would you do that? It's easy to say, but I don't fully understand what to do here.
Well, in Buddhism, we always start with ourselves. And in the teachings, there are Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and other awakened beings that are often taken as exemplars. But there's another exemplar that I feel now is really important. Persons of integrity, persons of good culture. Any community where the leaders, whether they're clergy, business people, school teachers, if they have integrity, if they uphold decent ethical values, if they treat others with kindness, and kindness is a important characteristic of integrity with this exemplar I'm speaking of, the person of character and integrity. That's almost a joke in mainstream media. The word Buddha means awakened or awakened one. And that's one of many terms that point to the aspiration of Buddhism. So using the word Buddha, Buddhist, Buddhism, Buddhist teachings, to be a sincere practicing Buddhist is to put awakening more and more central to one's life. And in the Buddhist perspective, that's not different than living with less and less suffering. it's the same as living unselfishly, living with kindness, decency, honesty.
So how does this happen? How do we, as a country, we're narrowing this down to the United States, how do we develop that integrity?
That's too big for the likes of me. I don't have that level of influence, but at least a few people are listening. So we start where each of us does soul searching, which is core to spiritual life, whatever terms we use. Like I draw on Buddhist teachings to examine areas where, oh, my integrity could use some improving. So that's one, personal. And we all can see where we might want to do some personal inner work with our own honesty, integrity. Like even somebody like our president is lying all the time. I suspect he can't distinguish because the psychology of persons without integrity, that's another Buddhist term, asaparisa, someone without integrity, saparisa, a decent, honest person of good character. People who aren't honest can't track what's true and not true. And they're probably lying to themselves much of the time. So these things take inner work. And then our personal work extends to our behavior towards others, how we earn a living, our relationships. So that's my personal work. And meditation and other things support that. And then second, since we all live in relationship with others, do we have the courage to talk about this among ourselves? Or are we so worried about ruffling feathers that we allow TikTok, Twitter, X, whatever, Facebook, these brain-numbing social media, they've got their value, but overall, they're not contributing to ethics and decency. Are we able in our families, with friends, at town hall meetings, do we just talk about the budget? Do we find ways to raise issues of integrity and honesty? I don't mean the ones our congressperson avoids. I mean, I live in Ridgeful Township. Our supervisors, I feel, have integrity. But that's not something we talk about publicly. It's not cool or it's shunned.
You are listening to WDRT's Radio Free Space. We return now to our interview with Buddhist teacher and translator, Santi Caro.
I'm a big fan of local government, and here in our small town, the past 4 years, I had certain things that I wanted to participate in on a city council level. And so I went to city council meetings, and I sometimes spoke, mainly listened. I became fascinated with how local government works. And there were and still are plenty of people with integrity at these meetings, both in the audience and at the tables. And that impresses me immensely and gives me hope that local government can work together. But we never talked about integrity. Nobody talked about integrity at those meetings, but that was present. The other thing that I see amongst friends and acquaintances, there's plenty of people talking about the problem, but it becomes an us versus them topic very quickly. What's your take on that?
Let me go back and say I agree with you that there's much more hope in finding and mutually supporting integrity locally. And it's unfortunate that our paradigm now for politics is the two-party capitalist system, which is run to benefit large corporations and rich investors and screws working people consistently, whichever side of the duopoly. As long as we're focused on that, it's pretty daunting. But I thank you for saying what you did, that locally there is integrity. The notion of mindfulness is helpful here. It's important to be mindful of such integrity. It's important to mention it and talk about it. Otherwise, it can be overlooked and not appreciated enough. Part of keeping healthy values alive is appreciating them in appropriate ways. And with large numbers of people not going to church together, we need other forums for that. It can be local theater, the music festival, as well as churches, meditation groups. But it's important to talk and appreciate what are the values that allow people to come together and work out the issues in a place like Viroqua.
How do you feel about the us versus them? That is fairly prevalent.
I'll look at that at two levels. First, having bought into that in elections, so we've boiled down democracy to elections. That's so simplistic. And it's allowed our democracy to be hijacked by money. And that's what, when America promotes democracy abroad, it promotes elections. I could give plenty of examples from Southeast Asia where elections may not mean democracy. And that could be happening here. So that's part of it. And when it's elections, we have a system that's structured, maybe unintentionally, to be a two-party system. The founders didn't believe in parties, but they happened fairly soon. And so when our idea of democracy is there are two parties, that's your choice. So we've got this overall framing of we have to take sides. And we have these two political parties that are selling themselves for the sake of power, doing the bidding of people who fund them. And many of them are now millionaires. Yeah. So we have parties that serve wealth and seek power. That's not what democracy is primarily about. So this is one big root of the us and them. Throw in talk radio, throw in the Facebook algorithm, and the hijacking of attention. People just fall into now us versus them thinking because we're not inoculated against those things. To draw on Buddhist teachings, when there is clinging to self, to me, myself, there will be other. You can't have self without other. In the dualistic operating of our thinking. So at the root of us versus them is me. And we used to embed me in a rich web of relationships and community. Back, I don't know, maybe back in the 50s or sometime, you went to high school with people, you stayed in the area, you had to live with people. Mm-hmm. The modern lifestyle we've created now makes it seem you don't have to live with people. I'm leaving out many details, but our sense of us has gotten smaller and smaller. And that's been exploited to sell us stuff. They get us to identify with things. Sports teams, which we were talking about before this interview. Back before it became huge, big business and increasingly politicized, that might have been fairly harmless. But there are all these ways that we become tribal. And it comes back to the me, that to maintain my me, I need other, or our us needs them. This is a pernicious part of psychology. And traditionally, healthy religion has been a way to mitigate that tribalism, like we're all God's children. But then some took, we're all God's children, except for those unbelievers. I think only one of those is genuine. The other's a corruption. And Buddhists have their versions of this. Here, we're attacking immigrants. There was the Muslim ban. There's the very cynical use of bogus anti-Semitism to suppress free speech concerning Palestinians and so forth. My view, without a spiritual practice of some sort, and it doesn't have to be Buddhism, but something that grounds us in love, in compassion, in decency, in what AA calls doing the right thing, or this civil rights movement, which was largely Christian, they did not hate white people. That was white fear and propaganda. It's not historically true, except for a few. There's always a few. Religion or spiritual practice in some form, I see as the most important way to inoculate us from these toxic influences, which are financed by big money, whereas local stuff doesn't require big money. It's pitching in and helping each other.
What level of hope do you have?
Depends what sort of hope you're talking about. Especially since November, a lot of my students in my Buddhist circles have spoken about hopelessness. And in talking, it's mostly they have no hope that we're going to effectively deal with climate change. They have no hope that the chicanery of the current regime will be reined in. They feel a sense of hopelessness of women's rights being trampled on, of racial injustices increasing and so forth. Much of that is about the future. I have lots of hope when my ego is not drawn into the perspective of worrying about the future. There is hope every moment in the ability of human consciousness to pay attention, to stop being seduced by our devices, etc., to stop swallowing the spin and just pay attention, like to the weather. At Kevala Retreat, the flowers are gorgeous right now, the birds. The three of us were talking about aging. We're still alive right now. Tomorrow, trickier question. Mm-hmm. But right now, we're alive, we're breathing. This is where hope is. And the hope in the basic decency of ordinary people, if we stop following corrupt leaders.
You've been listening to an interview with former Buddhist monk Santi Caro on Radio Free Space, WDRT's Community Access Hour. If you have a show you'd like to produce and broadcast, contact Terry O'Connor, Programming and Operations Coordinator, at terry@wdrt.org. This program was produced by Charlie Noer and by yours truly, Bill Motlong.